Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and industry leaders on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. I'll be joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby, State Director Tyler Sweeney, and partner at Des Moines, Iowa-based consulting firm LS2, Ashley Hunt. We'll be discussing the 2016 and 2020 presidential election cycles and grassroots efforts that took place or are taking place around those particular campaigns. But before we dive into today's discussion, let's kick off the program with our first segment, Facing the News. We will take a few minutes to see what is going on in the world of fiscal policy this week. The budget tracker for CQ Roll Call is reporting that Congress is at it again. Even after two extensions, it only has 3 weeks left to fund the government. While the impeachment inquiry carries on, lawmakers are also facing a December 20th deadline to finalize the spending bills that were technically due back at the beginning of October. We could be looking at yet another stopgap spending measure to avoid a government shutdown just before Christmas. Elected leaders have supposedly reached a bipartisan agreement to divvy up discretionary spending amongst the 12 appropriations bills, helping pave the way for finishing the legislation, and some members of Congress believe it will help at least get some of the bills passed before the holiday, but the agreement has not yet been made public. There's also no indication as to whether it resolves issues that brought the process to a screeching halt before, like funding for a southern border wall. Reducing the nation's debt is not priority number one on the campaign trail for presidential candidates, and it's barely a topic of conversation on the Hill. But some bipartisan lawmakers in the House are taking baby steps toward at least managing the nation's long-term debt by reforming the debt limit process. Before the Thanksgiving recess, legislation was introduced that would change the budget process so that public debt would be measured and limited as a share of the economy, or GDP. Under current law, the debt is capped at a numerical limit set by Congress, which must be raised whenever the Treasury needs more borrowing authority. The bill also seems similar to a broader Senate bill that would set a target for debt to GDP to maintain. Otherwise, a reconciliation process would be triggered to reduce the deficit. Even still, these recent actions are not likely to prompt a budget process or debt limit overhaul anytime soon. The Pentagon is trying to revise the way it builds and shops for weapons. The aim is to make the typically slow and cumbersome process faster and more efficient. Critics, however, worry the proposed new rules could lead to wasteful spending. Labor unions are pushing back against a plan by Senate Republicans to rescue failing pension plans. About 125 of 1,400 multi-employer plans are expected to become insolvent in the next 20 years. These plans, which cover 1.4 million people, have generally suffered demographic shifts. The AFL-CIO highly criticized the Senate's plan to boost insurance premiums and expand the authority of the Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation to take over benefit payments of failing plans as, quote, punitive in nature. The AFL-CIO previously endorsed a $68 billion multi-employer pension bill that passed the House in July, which contained more federal support, but many Republicans described it as merely a bailout. Up next, I'll be joined on the show by Concord Coalition's Executive Director Bob Bixby and State Director Tyler Sweeney. We'll be discussing some similarities between the 2016 and 2020 presidential election cycle and grassroots efforts occurring during both. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and New Hampshire State Director Tyler Sweeney. Bob, you know well. He's a regular contributor on the show. He also has filled in for me times past as host of the radio show. Tyler is a state and national campaign vet with with Concord. He works with local and state leaders around New Hampshire, educating citizens on the importance of civic engagement on issues related to federal fiscal policy. He conducts things like budget exercises, presentations, and these days, he also interacts with presidential candidates since we are in the 2020 New Hampshire primary cycle. Welcome back to Facing the Future, Bob and Tyler.
Thank you, Chase.
Always good to be back.
Always a pleasure to have my colleagues on the show. It's going to be, I think, a fun-filled conversation today, talking about the 2016 cycle and the 2020 cycle and what it's like to do grassroots initiatives during the New Hampshire primary and some of the initiatives that the Concord Coalition has worked on. And Tyler, you've played key roles in both of those cycles. Maybe I'll kick things off, Bob, to you, asking, I guess, a general question. What does Concord try to do during presidential elections? Like, what's our focus during in the grassroots realm when we have candidates all over the country doing events and that sort of thing?
Well, our focus is the same as it is at any time, which is educating about the federal debt and the consequences and the dangers of letting it grow to unsustainable heights. What we, you know, the added element in an election year is the opportunity it presents to ask candidates who are going to be the decision makers what they would do about it. First, you know, whether they think it's a priority and what ideas they have for dealing with it. So it's really public education in our usual sense, but also interacting with candidates to get them on the record about what they would do about the deficit. And if they don't think it's a problem, you know, tell us why. Tell the voters why.
What are some of the different tools or methods that what do we use to try and get those candidates on the record?
Well, it's a mix of things. You know, we sometimes organize volunteers to go to candidate events, as we do in New Hampshire and in Iowa. And Tyler can speak more to that because he's actually been going out to these things, and as you have as well. So that's something we're not able to be everywhere, but certainly we can be in those states and also some other states where people can interact with candidates. We encourage volunteers to do that. They don't have to have us organize them. People are welcome to go do it on their own. Look at our website, get information, and go ask the candidates. We also put out an issue guide, which is on our website, and that looks at overall fiscal policy and some other things like healthcare spending and Social Security and taxes. And it's pretty, you know, plainly written document. It's got a lot of numbers in it, but it's not like a deep dive sort of thing. It just sort of gives people an idea of why these issues are important and a little background information to inform the questions that they might ask of the candidates. And we often do a questions for the candidates brochure. If you can't think of a good question, we might have, you know, a list of 6 or 7 questions specifically. We haven't done our 2020 brochure yet, but we probably will.
And Bob, you made a good point earlier about how we're a relatively small organization. I know we have got a great volunteer base across the country, but I think what I like about the early state primaries and caucuses, specifically Iowa and New Hampshire, is it gives us an opportunity, I guess, to, in a sense, punch above our weight, having a pretty large impact early on in the election cycle. And Tyler, it might be a good time to bring you in here. You got involved with the Concord Coalition during the last presidential cycle, 2015-2016, as an intern in an effort called First Budget, which is something that the Concord Coalition partnered on with other organizations to do what Bob basically just said, engage the candidates, get them on the record, talking about fiscal policy issues. So why don't we start there? What was your experience like as an intern engaging in the First Budget campaign?
Well, that was honestly, the time of my life. We had a couple of us. There was 3 interns throughout the First Budget process, and we literally traveled to every town in the state during the first during that part of the election cycle, and we engaged firsthand with every candidate that was running. I think I had a tally going of like 220 before I lost count, and we were right in their faces asking them very specific policy questions, you know, real detail-oriented questions. And we had a very visual impact on the race at hand. We were known by, on a first-name basis by several of the candidates by the end of our time there. But that's part of what happens when you're in New Hampshire. It's a small state, and when you get up in a town hall like that, you really get noticed, and the candidates take notice of what you're saying. So it's a very important part of what Concord does.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. We were so all over the state that I actually lost weight during that campaign. Didn't eat, did a lot of driving, and sat and stood in a lot of hot rooms because New Hampshire, there's not a lot of central air conditioning, especially when you get to some of those smaller towns and get into a town hall building that's, you know, 200 years old, and there's about 150 people crammed into a room, and you're all trying to get the candidate's attention. You know, those were great days. Wouldn't you agree, Tyler?
That was the best part. Actually, I think that was the last campaign that I worked on where I did lose weight.
Well, you know, there's nothing new. I worked on a campaign, and I won't give the year, but it was some time ago. And I was the driver for the candidate, and we went around the state. And, you know, I learned to eat because we never stopped for regular meals. So, you know, if you went to somebody's house for a meet and greet or something like that, I wouldn't go scrounging around in the closets or something, but I mean, if they put out food, that was my dinner. So I you know, that was something to really look forward to. I got to know all of the different party platters that people would put out, and that was dinner.
So I had the same experience.
You knew how the event was going to go based on what platter you saw. Like, oh, they skimped on this one. This is going to be a brief experience.
It's going to be a brief campaign.
Right. I mean, the candidates would go to shake hands, and I'd go to the food tray and see what was on offer.
So, Bob, when we kicked off First Budget, what were you hoping it would accomplish?
Well, I was hoping that you'd get the candidates on the record, for one thing, and about fiscal issues, and secondly, hoping that it would generate some momentum, more questions, that people would hear our questions and follow up, and there'd be a vigorous discussion in the media and in the campaign trail about what our fiscal options were and what the dangers were of doing nothing. To anticipate your next question, I don't think it worked.
Okay, whoa. No, as one of the guys down there trying to make that happen, that was my next question.
No, I mean, I think, you know, there's only so much you can do. I think we did do exactly what we set out to do in terms of the logistics of it and the tactics of it. We got, with the three interns and Chase, I mean, you covered the campaigns really, really well. And the candidates and their staffs knew you were there. And as I recall, explicitly called on you a couple of times because they wanted that question, the candidates that wanted to talk about it. And we got very good coverage in the media. And this was true in Iowa as well as New Hampshire. So, but it wasn't a year where fiscal issues were front and center. And what we wanted to have was the new president, whoever was going to come in, because it was going to be a new president one way or the other, because Obama was term limited. We wanted to have the new president present a quote unquote first budget that was aimed at doing something about reducing the debt to GDP ratio over the long term. And, you know, we really didn't get that. It wasn't a priority of the incoming administration. And, you know, I don't know that that would have been any different had the other candidate won.
Yeah, I think one of the advantages we have had at that time, and probably still to this day, is it was such a small state, such a small territory, so many candidates packed into a small area, and we hit so many of the events that we were recognized, and sometimes that was good, and sometimes that was bad. But most of the time, it was good, because we did a really good job, and Tyler especially helped with the making sure the interns were good at this as well, is building a relationship with the campaign staff and the candidates themselves. So much so that I think Tyler might have gotten a couple job offers along the way because he was very good at what he did. But it wasn't you know, to your point, Bob, it wasn't long lasting because eventually whoever won didn't make fiscal policy issues their number one issue. And I think a lesson I've learned is in hindsight, it doesn't have to be a number one issue for someone, but there has to be the acknowledgement of the reality that no matter what your number one issue is, fiscal policy impacts it. And that's something I'm taking into the 2020 cycle as we're interacting with candidates now. And Tyler has been just itching to say something, so I'm going to roll over to him.
You know, you were saying that it wasn't a big focus point for most of the candidates during the last cycle, and this cycle is just about a carbon copy. I wouldn't say that it's worse this time around. There are some candidates that are, you know, mentioning it. They're not necessarily in the top tier currently. But there are people that are talking about how we have to be addressing pain for the things that we're promising. It's also a different party, so it's a little different in the structure and way they're going about it. But I had a conversation with Bob a couple of days ago about websites and how that's really it really shows you what the candidate truly cares about. And Bob, you've gone through a few of the websites already, and how is it looking in terms of, you know, does anybody address the issue on their website front and center, or is it hidden in there? Is it there at all?
Well, I think that I will answer that question, and I will also kind of pose an invitation to people listening is go to the candidate websites, all of them on both sides, and look for some sort of acknowledgement that the debt is a problem and that it has to be taken into account when you introduce new policy initiatives. It's an interesting exercise. I haven't found that yet. And like you said, I don't think it's it shouldn't be a candidate's top priority. You would expect that they would have substantive policies that they care about. And the question then is, do they have some way to pay for them, because we've actually got an unsustainable budget situation as it is? And then a third tier question would be, third layer down would be, are those plans to pay for new initiatives credible? So far, I've found it very interesting because my experience going back on websites to look at budget proposals goes back a ways, and probably to the I'm not sure if the candidate's head website.
I was going to say, was this pre website days, Bob? Back when only the leaflet existed,
were they pre Tyler days?
Definitely so. With the advent of websites, we had a few cycles there where you could go on candidate websites and they would actually have budgets. Fiscal responsibility was an issue tab. You know, you'd go, most candidate websites look very similar, by the way. And they've usually got something you can click on that says issues or policies or vision or something like that. And a bunch of topics will drop down. And it used to be that, you know, fiscal policy or balancing the budget or something like that would be on the list. I haven't found any candidates that have something like that on the list, and you know, something that relates to the debt. So it's definitely is an indicator, because they're showing you their priorities, but they're also appealing to what they think people want to read about. So it's what it's telling me is that I'm not sure if this chicken or the egg problem is that the voters, they don't think the voters want to hear about it, or the candidates don't want to talk about it. I think it's probably more the latter, because if candidates would rather talk about all of the things that they're going to do in terms of new programs and the money they're going to spend or the taxes they're going to cut. And so acknowledging that there has to be some sort of trade-off there is not something candidates are anxious to talk about.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and New Hampshire State Director Tyler Sweeney were discussing the 2016 and 2020 presidential election cycles and some grassroots efforts associated with both. And Bob, you mentioned, I think, three of the five, what we call the five P's coming out of the first budget initiative, and that's something we've rolled over into the 2020 effort. It might be a benefit if you could run through those five P's just very concisely so our listeners know what they are and know what they can be asking of candidates. And by the way, those five P's can be found in the issue guide that Bob mentioned earlier in the show.
Yeah, and that's on our website on the homepage. First, does the candidate acknowledge that the growing debt is a serious problem? So that's the first P, is it a problem? Second is dealing with the debt a priority in their campaigns? And again, we don't expect people to say that this is the number one priority, but it has to be, it has to take into account their other priorities and make sure that it comes out in a fiscally responsible way. The third is, do they have a plan for what they would do, not just what they would refuse to do? And I'm talking here about establishing fiscal sustainability. You find a lot of candidates will take things off the table, saying, well, I will never do X, and rather than telling you, you know, what they would do. And by the way, I don't know whether Tyler has experienced this or not, but I seem to recall when that question is asked of candidates, a lot of times they will default to that, this is what I won't do. You know, what would you do about the debt? Well, I wouldn't do, and then they list a bunch of things that they think that the other side has done that would be bad. So the fourth one is what we talked about, how would you pay for your new policy initiatives? Very important. It's sometimes called pay-go or pay-as-you-go, which means that if you're going to enact some big new spending program or enact a big tax cut, how do you prevent that from making our long-term debt situation even worse? And the final one, which is called public, and basically that means engaging the public in these issues. If you're going to make some sort of deficit reduction effort or have a mandate to look at the budget and the debt after you become president, you really have to let the public know that you have to seek that as part of your mandate, and you have to engage with the public during the campaign on that issue to explain, all these other P's, what your plan is and how you would pay for it.
And Bob, you said something else earlier that caught my attention, and that was the word vision, and how in the past candidates have painted a vision that has included at least elements of fiscal policy or some of the fiscal challenges we're facing, and it seems like that is lacking quite a bit. And I'm surprised by that. I'm a little disappointed, because I think painting a vision gives you an opportunity to tie all of these things together and not only be, you know, realistic about the challenges we're facing, but, you know, be hopeful about the changes that can be made and the opportunity to engage in those changes at the right time and in the right manner. So I actually have a challenge for you, a bit of an exercise I'd like to see if you could perform. Can you take some of the general themes of this cycle, the 2020 candidates and what they're talking about, and tie some of them to the fiscal challenges, or at least a handful of the fiscal challenges we're facing as a nation?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good way to put it, because part of what we're seeing here in the websites is it's not necessarily that the candidates don't care about fiscal responsibility. I mean, or don't know about it. I mean, I would like them to be more upfront about it and communicating on their websites. But when you look at them, it may be an evolving way of talking about it, and I think people like us who care about the budget ought to be open to that interpretation, which is people do care about, and a lot of the campaigns have sections on things like workforce training and the changing nature of the workforce, supporting apprenticeships and retraining and relearning because the workforce is changing, and people are beginning to realize that the federal government's response is perhaps a little bit behind the times, and that more needs to be done in that area. I think that there are people that look at innovations in technology that the federal government should be investing more. and investing it in things that will help grow the economy. I think that there's a focus on immigration. A lot of the issue tabs that come down will include immigration, and how that factors into the economy and the workforce needs. And definitely healthcare. I mean, I think that's, if there's one that cuts across all of them, I think it's healthcare and different plans for lowering healthcare costs. And those are really the big initiatives that I noticed that seem to be on all of those websites. Coincidentally, most of them are part of our fiscally responsible economic growth agenda, which I was happy to see, because, you know, we came out with these papers in October, and they're available on our website. So I think that this idea of policy initiatives that would help grow the economy is something that Democrats and Republicans could have a real interesting debate on, and we have our papers. The missing element is a fiscally responsible approach, because it's not clear from looking at the websites how all these things would be paid for without making the deficit worse. And that gets to your original point going in here, Chase, which I think is really the key, is, you know, painting that vision of these changes that can be incorporated into a long-term vision that doesn't just rely on ever-growing debt, because that's ultimately unsustainable. So if your vision for the future is, well, the debt is going to be, you know, it's 89, you know, it's 80% of GDP now, and under my vision, it's going to be 300% of GDP 20 years from now. I mean, that's not a sustainable vision.
I just want to jump in real quick. I think you're absolutely right. This is, if nothing else, the year of healthcare. It's been definitely dominating the conversation. Immigration has come in as well, and so has workforce. But one thing I wanted to tie it back into with the five P's is that they normally get the first three P's. It's the last two P's where they talk about paying for it and then the plan to engage the public on these issues. That's where they kind of, you know, they just don't. So I just wanted to throw that in. That's what my experience in New Hampshire has been for the past couple months.
And I'm going to bounce right back to the vision topic that Bob was laying out there and I guess tie in the 5P conversation. But is it, from your view, Bob, is it incumbent upon organizations and advocates like ourselves, or incumbent upon the candidates to connect the dots, as it were, with that kind of vision? You know, is it, should we be there helping them, or should we be calling upon them to do it themselves?
Well, I think we need to be calling upon them, because we're not running for anything. So it's, you know, it's, we don't demand that they adopt our vision. But in assessing their visions, What role we play is to say, okay, is this credible as a matter of fiscal policy? Because we don't take a position about big government versus small government. We don't endorse candidates. We don't endorse parties. We don't oppose parties or oppose political candidates. So I think our role is to, A, encourage or remind people that we have an unsustainable fiscal situation as we have it now, and frankly, ask the candidates, how do you plan to deal with this? And, you know, if their answer is, I don't, because I don't think there's a problem, go ahead and tell people that, and people can assess whether or not that's credible. If they say, yeah, it is a problem, then they have to say how they would fit their vision, whatever their vision is, into that that fiscal constraint. So I think that's really our role.
And we have time for, I'm going to say, two questions. I'm going to ask both of you a very similar question. We'll start with Tyler, and then Bob will roll to you to finish up the segment. So the question to you, Tyler, and Bob, I'll give you a heads up on what your question will be. But Tyler, how have things changed on the ground from the grassroots perspective, from the 2016 cycle to 2020. It could be good, could be bad. And then, Bob, how have things changed in terms of fiscal policy, our nation's fiscal health from that period to now, whether it's better or worse or the long-term trajectory is about the same? And we'll start with Tyler.
Well, the tone and tenor tend to be a little more us or them in terms of the party politics of it all. The size of the field is also pretty large, which normally would make the events smaller. But I've found that even the lower tier candidates, even if they're polling 3 or 4%, they're pulling in huge numbers of people compared to what I saw during the Republican primary in 2016. Because they had a large field as well, but when you were polling at 3 or 4%, you could expect maybe, I don't know, 20, 30 people in a room. With these candidates, you know, you're pulling at 3 or 4%, you're pulling in maybe 100 at your good rallies, which is a sizable crowd for something like that.
Especially in New Hampshire.
Especially
that's
in New Hampshire.
That's the caveat in New Hampshire.
People are going out that aren't normally out there. I'm seeing a lot of young faces. I'm seeing a lot of energy from both sides of the aisle. And it's I'm hopeful that we're going to see a larger voter turnout as a result of the you know, the competition. I'm not as hopeful about what this all says about our you know, how we feel about each other right now.
Well, I'm hopeful those new voters or younger voters pay attention to these issues. I know there are a lot of issues to be concerned about from the generational perspective, but like I said before, it all ties back to the federal budget because that's
absolutely
where the resources are.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that I think 90% of our volunteers in New Hampshire have been college students.
All right, Bob, over to you. What's changed in the policy realm?
Well, that last comment from Tyler is very encouraging, so I'll turn us back into the discouraging stuff.
Oh, wonderful.
We're all the ghosts of Christmas. We got like a Christmas carol going on here,
Bring us back down to earth, Bob.
No, I think that, you know, how has the fiscal picture changed? It's gotten much worse. And that's, you know, we said it would. If you don't do anything, it's going to keep getting worse because on autopilot, we have a mismatch between spending and revenue. So if you don't change things, that keeps getting worse. Now, what's happened is we did have the one big initiative was a big tax cut. So the revenue line is less than would have been expected under projections before the tax cut happened. And, you know, spending has gone up as well. So the revenue line has gone down, the spending line has gone up, and so the budget deficit is worse and the debt is higher as a percentage of GDP. We used to be warning that, you know, within, you know, the second administration of the new president, you know, would have $1 trillion deficits, and we are projected to have a $1 trillion deficit in the current fiscal year, 2020. So a lot of those problems have actually moved up. None of the structural changes that need to be made have been made or even debated. And as I said, we had the one major initiative was a big tax cut that was for whatever good parts it had in terms of simplifying the tax code or encouraging growth by cutting taxes, it doesn't pay for itself and it makes the long-term outlook worse. So I do think that that's actually a reason for people to be more concerned even than they might have been in 2016.
I think to Tyler's point, we should stop throwing punches at the other side simply because they're the other side. And to your point, Bob, we need to start having a debate or discussion on a lot of these issues because they've only gotten worse. And most projections have them going down that path, no matter what the vision is that these candidates are throwing out there. This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord's Executive Director Bob Bixby and State Director Tyler Sweeney. We discussed the 2016 and 2020 presidential election cycles and grassroots efforts surrounding them. Thank you both for joining the show once again.
Thanks, Chase.
Until next time.
After the break, Bob and I will be joined by Ashley Hunt, a partner at Des Moines-based LS2 and former Concord colleague. We'll be looking at the social media side of the campaign trail with Ashley. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. I'm joined on the show by Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and partner at the Des Moines-based consulting firm LS2, Ashley Hunt. Bob, you know well. He's a regular contributor on the show. Ashley, as I mentioned, is a partner with LS2. She specializes in public affairs, social and digital media, and even event management. She was previously the Grassroots and Outreach Director for Concord, where she specialized in social media and digital grassroots activation. Ashley's also very plugged into her local community, serving on several boards and commissions. She's been on the show before, but it's been quite a while. Welcome back to the show, Bob and Ashley.
Thanks, Chase.
Thank you. I'm excited to be back.
Well, we're happy to have you back on the show. I certainly miss your help in the office and all the efforts that we've been working on with Concord. And Bob and I talked a little bit about those in the previous segment, and we went into detail on the first budget initiative, which I want to talk about a little bit more in this segment as well, but more on the social media side and what you did in Iowa. But before we get there, maybe you can explain to our listeners what you do for LS2 now and what you were doing for Concord way back then.
Yeah, sure. So currently I'm a partner at LS2 Group. We are a public relations, public affairs, government affairs, marketing, event management, crisis communications firm, basically you name it. We're based out of Des Moines, but we've got offices all across the Midwest. I personally am also based in Des Moines. Been with LS2 Group for about 5 years. A couple of years ago, let's see, 2017, I worked full-time with you guys at Concord Coalition, but I've been working with you guys off and on, doing consulting work pretty much for the last 4 or 5 years as well. When I was at Concord, ran all of the social media, digital media stuff, and helped a lot on the ground in Iowa. At LS2 Group now, I specialize in social media, lead a lot of that work here in the office. And then, of course, the public affairs work. We are, you know, a pretty political state, being the first in the nation caucus. So we do a lot of issue advocacy stuff here, especially around presidential primary and caucus time. And then I also lead our events department. We do a ton of different events, conferences, town halls, basically you name it. A lot of, again, issue advocacy type stuff.
It was definitely a good match considering I'm in the first in the nation primary state of New Hampshire. Yes, so tooting our horn there. Let's talk a little bit about what you did for Concord early on during the first budget initiative. I know you did a little bit of grassroots work there in terms of events. But what were you doing on the social media side of things, and how has that played a role in that election, also looking at ahead at 2020?
Yeah, so I think you're seeing a major shift in the role social media is playing from 2016 to now 2020. It's been really interesting to kind of watch everything evolve. So in 2016, we did do a little bit of social media, but I would say if we were running the same campaign today, that it would look a lot different in terms of what we would be doing on social. So in 2016, it was a pretty minimal effort, I'd say. We had the hashtag. We talked about what was happening in Iowa. We encouraged our volunteers who were on the ground to take photos, to tweet out, to tag or mention the candidates, write the answers down, that sort of thing. And then we'd also work with the volunteers in the state who maybe weren't at the event but cared about the issue to blast it out to their social networks, retweeting, sharing, that sort of thing. So a little bit of an effort around social media in 2016, but I would say today, if we were running it, we'd probably be going full speed ahead on social, just knowing how much more the candidates are using social in terms of campaigning.
So when you say different, Ashley, what changes would you make? Because I'm an older millennial, and things like hashtags and tagging candidates and other individuals, that's pretty much all I can do on social media. What's the next step up? Like, how do you really emphasize efforts in social media?
In terms of what the candidates are doing, let's talk a little bit about that first. You're seeing candidates do Facebook Lives. You're seeing them turn directly to voters on the social platforms. Obviously, we're in the age of the presidency with Donald Trump, where tweeting is sometimes how he announces policies. And so I think that's sort of encouraging other candidates from both sides of the aisle to turn to social media a little bit more often. And you're seeing folks announce policies, again, via social media. Something in Iowa that we've been seeing that's been really interesting is television stations broadcasting social media-only content. So, for example, back in the gubernatorial race in 2018, they were doing debates and one-on-ones with the candidates that was only available via Facebook Live. And these are television stations. So we're really seeing sort of that shift from media and candidates to kind of working more on that social platform, which is really great, especially for the candidates, because you get that direct contact. You don't have to go through that gateway of the media. And as we've also been seeing, voters aren't necessarily trusting the media as much as they used to with the rise of the term fake news. So that's been really good for candidates. So with the media doing this, with candidates turning to social media more often, it's really important for issue advocacy groups to also turn to social media and to make sure that they're taking space on the platform. The other thing that we should probably take into consideration when we're talking about the importance of social media when it comes to issue advocacy or brand awareness or whatever it may be is the changes to political advertising that we've seen both on Facebook and on Twitter recently. So Facebook has sort of become more of a pay-to-play platform. You'll see that they get a majority, like 90% or something crazy, of their revenue from just advertising. That's sort of different than their competitors in the tech space where other tech companies are getting their revenue from products and that sort of thing. So Facebook is really heavily relying on ad revenue. And then Twitter just recently banned all political advertising. So that's also a shift that we're seeing in the 2020 race. With Facebook being a pay-to-play, it's really important that people are putting dollars behind ads because we've got to get out there. But more importantly, it's finding new and unique ways to reach your voters or your constituents or your volunteers, stakeholders, whatever it may be. So it's beyond just the tagging. It's beyond the hashtags. Should you be doing that? Absolutely. That is still an extremely important portion of social media activating. What's also important is that creative way to get your followers engaged or new eyes engaged. So going live on Facebook, tweeting in real time and sharing that if you're at an event on the ground, what is happening, being that sort of citizen journalism aspect that we're seeing more often. And then you're seeing more polls, you've got Instagram stories, you've got Facebook stories. So it's sort of moving beyond just tagging and talking about something, hashtagging, whatever, into more real-time stuff, more direct, immediate content that is relatable and unique.
Relatable. That's something that's definitely very hard for the topic of fiscal policy. And Bob, we haven't had a chance for you to weigh in yet. Do you have a question for Ashley before we have to go here in a couple minutes?
Well, I'm just curious, does the social media explosion help or hurt grassroots turnout? I mean, does it just make it different? If I'm a candidate, do I turn out people by going on social media, or do they do everything on social media and they don't go to a town hall event or a living room coffee?
Yeah, I think the answer is both. It can help and it can hurt. So obviously candidates are going more to social media to turn out for events. You've got organizers on the ground creating Facebook events, and they're using that to get their RSVP counts. The other thing is the Facebook events have a section where you can say interested, and a lot of people are just putting interested to keep it on their calendar. So it's not really an accurate way to turn out attendance necessarily. You won't get the best representation of audience numbers. So great, because you're getting more eyes on your content, but it can be bad. I think you need to sort of mix a combination of social media activation with your traditional tactics to get folks to the events. So it's sort of a combo there. And as for whether it's a good or bad thing for grassroots organizations, I think it's a majority of good, right? We're getting so many more opportunities to connect with people who might be interested in this issue And especially for nonprofits who don't have millions of dollars to spend on direct mailing and TV advertising and that sort of thing, it's a relatively low-cost way to reach interested parties, stakeholders, volunteers, etc. So you're just getting more brand awareness and more eyes on your content and on the issue.
This is Facing the Future. I've been talking to Concord Coalition Executive Director Bob Bixby and partner at LS2 in Des Moines, Iowa, Ashley Hunt. Sorry this is such a short segment, Ashley. We certainly could have taken a deeper dive on some of these issues. We've been talking about social media and that side of the campaign, especially as it relates to the 2016 and 2020 campaign cycles. Thank you both for joining the show.
Thank you
so much.
You've been Facing the Future. I'm Chase Hageman. Thanks for listening.